Telling you a little bit about these algebras of q-semicircular elements. So they were introduced by Bozeiko and Speicher. I think in 91. And the idea is to construct a kind of deformation, not in the sense of Sering Popa, but in a much, much kind of broader sense, a kind of a deformation of free group factors. So you have a parameter q in this range between minus 1 and 1, and you have an n, which is 1, 2, 3, etc., or plus infinity. And associated to that, you get a certain factor. Let's call it MQ N, for lack of a better name. And it is generated, it's a Feynman algebra generated by N variables, X1Q, XNQ, where these are exactly this Q semicircular. And it has a trace. And the point is that in the case that q equals 0, this mq of n is just a free group factor. And this q semicircular family is exactly Voiculescu's free semicircular family. So it's just one of the usual ways to generate a free group factor. If q is equal to negative 1, then these xj minus 1, they satisfy the canonical anti-commutation relation, so they generate a Carr algebra, and actually what you get out of this is just a finite dimensional matrix algebra. The dimension is 2 to the n, or a hyperfinite 2-1 factor if n is equal to infinity. And in the case that q equals plus 1, these xj's satisfy the canonical commutation relations, and for this algebra ends up being abelian because it's not exactly Q, well, they're related to the Q commutation relations, they're the real parts of operators that satisfy the canonical commutation relations. Anyways, what they end up generating is an abelian Feynman algebra, which is exactly the sigma algebra generated by an n-tuple of Gaussian random variables. And that was actually the big motivation for them, because you see, the free semicircular variables, that is the case q equals 0, they play a fundamental role in free probability theory. They're kind of the free Gaussian variables. Q equals 1 are the standard Gaussian variables, so this way you get a kind of interpolation between classical probability theory and free probability theory, which also extends to some kind of Z2 graded probability theory, which is that case. And somehow, because of that, it was interesting and, well, anyway. But what I want to concentrate here is actually what are these Feynman algebras. And, well, there's not really much you can say, unfortunately, about who they are. Fortunately, one can say a lot more about their properties. So properties of M cube of N. And by the way, the kind of overshadowing this big question, are MQN isomorphic to free group factors for Q strictly big, strictly inside this interval, or not? I mean, of course, at the endpoints of the interval, they're either abelian or hyperfinite, so they aren't, but inside, it's not known. So I'm going to list some properties which actually provide very weak support for the... Well, anyways, they certainly cannot distinguish these algebras from that, so we still don't know, and could take it as evidence that they are, but taking anything as evidence in the Feynman algebra category is kind of dangerous. But anyways, so the properties are, well, first of all, they're factors. This actually has quite a long story. So I think Bozeiko Speicher, maybe in the original paper, maybe shortly after that, proved that for N equals infinity, so if you have an infinite semicircular family, then there are factors. Then after some effort, I think it was Shniadi in 2001 or 2002, who gave a proof that there are factors for small q, plus then on gamma. And then Eric Ricard, I think in 05 or 06, showed that they're all factors for all q. Of course, n has to be at least 2. If n equals 1, then these algebras are abelian, and there's just one single self-adjoint that generates them. So in fact, they are even non-gamma factors, at least for some values of Q. Then Mu showed in the 90s that they are non-hyperfinite. Of course, for Q in this range. Then I made a fairly stupid observation that they satisfy what Ozawa calls property AO, and so by Ozawa they ended up being solid, which means that any subalgebra which is non-hyperfinite cannot have a large commutant. Okay. And now what the new thing is, we have now Cartan subalgebra. So this is, unfortunately, this is for Q less than about 0.41 or something like this, because actually it's sort of silly, because to prove this, I mean, the key thing is, well, there's a certain boundary kind of Sista algebra you have to consider, and you have to know that that boundary Sista algebra is nuclear. And that boundary Sista algebra is exactly the one that's generated not by the semicircular variables, but the so-called Q creation operators, which act on some Fock space. And you need to know that that algebra is nuclear. And I was just lazy and used the result of Dykema and Nika, who proved that actually for Q in this range, that Sista algebra is an extension of the Kunz algebra and therefore nuclear. But I mean, I imagine one could probably prove directly that it's nuclear in a much broader range of Q. But anyways, so that was really the only thing. Anyways, the news is that they have no Cartan subalgebra for small q. So if n, unfortunately q depends on n, so if n equals 2, q must be between 0 and 0. I think it's 2.6 that I get, and for large n, 0 between q and about a quarter of n squared. So they have no Cartan. Actually, it's stronger. What I prove is that they have a free entropy dimension over a set of generators of this x1q, xnq is strictly bigger than 1. So that implies that they have no Cartan subalgebra by Voiculescu's result. Actually, the result is stronger. I mean, Voiculescu's result is stronger. What you get is that this mq of n, if you view it as a bimodule over any abelian subalgebra, contains L2 of A, tensor L2 of A, or a piece of it for any A abelian. So it's stronger than having no Cartan. It's not just saying that there's no quasi-normalizer of any abelian subalgebra. It's saying that no abelian subalgebra, I mean, every abelian subalgebra is very, very singular in the sense that the L2 of the whole algebra has a copy of the left regular, the coarse correspondence associated with the algebra. So let me tell you the story of how I got into proving this. So, you see, more generally, we want a technique for showing
the delta of some set x1, xn, the free entropy dimension delta naught is bigger than 1.
So the free entropy dimension is a quantity that I think was mentioned already to some extent or another. For sure it is going to appear a lot in Kenley Chung's talk, so maybe I more or less defer the definition of everything to Kenley. But very vaguely, what this delta naught of x1, xn is very vaguely, it's the following thing. So you look at all embeddings of the Feynman algebra generated by x1, xn into the alpha product of matrices, so this means the product of these guys as non-product of these guys divided by sequences that in L2 norm could go to zero after this alpha filter. So you consider all such embeddings. Now, if you have an embedding here, an embedding alpha, you associate to it, associate to it an n-tuple, let's say x1, xn, let me just put it with this, alpha of x1, alpha of xn, okay, inside, let's call this guy script m, inside m to the n self-adjoint, right? Because of course any embedding is determined by what it does to the generators, so given an embedding, you should just look at the images of the generators. And what this delta naught of x1, xn, it's a kind of dimension, but relative to M, whatever that means, or the set of all these alpha of x1, alpha of xn, where alpha is an embedding. Okay, so this is kind of as precise as I'm going to get in this talk about this. What do you mean by this dimension relative to M? Well, it's a kind of covering dimension, so Kenley Jung gave an interpretation of this as a covering dimension, but what do? You look at all matrices, so given, the way you understand the set is that you look at all, let's say, x1, xn, which are actually in matrices, which approximate these guys, so this is called a set of microstates, and then you take a covering dimension of these viewed as a subset of k by k matrices, but this dimension gets renormalized by 1 over k squared, you renormalize the dimension so that each one of these matrix algebras receives dimension 1 as opposed to dimension k squared. And consequently, this is why I'm saying that it's a kind of a dimension relative to M. It means that the whole, unit ball of this, ultra product of matrices somehow ends up being counted as having dimension 1. This is what I mean by kind of a relative dimension. Okay, so this is somehow a relation with the talk of Nate Brown, where he was talking about not doing this, but just taking the usual kind of covering dimension. So that's the difference between free entropy dimension and that kind of stuff. Anyway, so what we want is a general technique for showing that this quantity, this kind of dimension of embeddings is big. Why do we want to do that? Well, because we have these theorems of Voigt-Wieskau that once free entropy dimension is big, then the algebra has various properties, in particular has no Cartan set algebra. Now, what is curious is that essentially the technique involves construction of a certain deformation now in the sense of Popper, so actually the theorem one has is the following. Suppose that
So let's say you're given some x1, xn, and assume that there exists an automorphism of one parameter family of embeddings, say alpha t, from the Feynman algebra generated by this x1, xn, to the Feynman algebra generated by x1, xn, free product of free group factor, say L of F infinity, with the following property. So let's say that this has some semicircular family in it, S1, S2, S3, etc., semicircular family. With the following property that if I look at alpha t of xj, then this looks like xj plus t times some, let's say, some q jk sk plus higher order terms. So in other words, I'm assuming that this family of embeddings, when restricted to my generators of the algebra, is somehow differentiable, and that this is the beginning of the Taylor series expansion for such a family. Okay? So in other words, this deformation is to zeroth order just doing nothing, of course, because at time t equals zero it's not doing anything, and to first order it's just deforming in the direction of these three semicirculars that are generating the free group factor, and then to higher order terms it does what it has to do. Okay? So assume you have that. Now, these qij, what are they? Well, I should have put here like that. What is this qjk? Well, qjk is something that sits in the Feynman algebra of x1, xn, tensor itself. So, what I mean here by sharp is that if I have a tensor, A tensor B, then that sharp S means that I'm multiplying S on the left and on the right by this tensor. So it's not very hard to see that actually, because these SKs are free from the Feynman algebra generated by X1, Xn, that this algebra acts on SKs on the left and the right. So any element in this Feynman algebra tensor product actually can act on SK. In fact, what happens is that the operator norm of this element is controlled in terms of the L2 norm of this thing. So it actually extends to L2 tensor L2. So the statement then is that the free entry to dimension, okay, the last condition, let's just assume that this is embeddable into this ultra power of matrices. Then the free entropy dimension of x1, xn is bounded from below by the non-Feynman dimension of the image of Q. Now you see this matrix Q, let's even say that this K goes from 1 to n, so that this Qij is a matrix. So Q, you can think of it as a map from the Feynman algebra generated by x1, xn, tensor itself to itself. Just by using it as a matrix of left multiplication operators, let's say. Or let's say it was a matrix of right multiplication operators, then this image is a right module, and what happens is that the Murray-Feynman dimension of that module is exactly a lower estimate for the free entropy dimension. So, if you like, you could say that this theorem is a kind of, very, very weak form of a kind of deformation rigidity statement, meaning to say that if you know that delta naught is 1, then it prohibits certain deformations from existing. Okay. So deformations of a certain kind cannot exist because free entropy dimension is equal to 1. So in particular, if you know that your algebra has a Cartan subalgebra, which would mean that this free entropy dimension is equal to 1, then deformations of this kind are prohibited. Okay.
What is Q?
Q is, I'm just postulating, there exists some Q in here, qjk are some elements from here,
Okay, there are some. I mean, it could be, for instance, that Q is zero, in which case my theorem is saying nothing. Or it could be, I'll show you actually interesting cases where these things exist. And the point is that if you know that such a deformation exists for some Q, then you get a lower bound on free entropy dimension in terms of that Q. This Q is interpreted as a multiplier, and the dimension of its image is some number, and that number is a lower estimate for free entropy dimension. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have said, Q. I don't know how you say it. Q. IJ, yeah. This matrix. This matrix that appeared in here. QJK, whatever. No. None whatsoever. It just has to be in here. In fact, I'm happy with it even being an L2 of that. So, the statement actually is rather easy to prove. Let me give you a proof of it in the case that QIJ is the identity matrix. So in other words, if you think of it as acting as a multiplier, then this is just the identity matrix. So the matrix of Q, QIJK, is the identity from So in other words, in that case, I'm claiming that this free entropy dimension is no less than n. In fact, there's an obvious estimate that free entropy dimension is always at most n. So actually, in that case, I'm proving that delta naught is equal to n. So the proof is very simple. Look, let's look at the set of all of my alphas like this. So say I have an embedding alpha, and I look at all such embeddings. So here's, so this is the set of all possible, the set of all these where alpha is an embedding of my von Neumann algebra into this ultra power over script n. So here's a specific, point. Let's call it little x1, little xn. So little x1, little xn are just the images of x1, xn under some specific alpha. Now, let's look what happens if I perturb them by a semicircular variable. Well, according to this theorem, if I take these xj's and perturb them by semicircular variables, that's what happens if you put in q equals identity. What you get here is xj plus tsj. So if I add t is semicircular variable, then if I look here at call it beta. Sorry, it's a confusion of notation here. If I look at beta of alpha t of x1, xn, then if you think a little about it, you'll see that this beta has distance t squared to those guys. This is simply because in free probability terms, the law of this alpha t of xj is the same as the law of xj's. So here's another embedding of the xj's, which is very close to my original xj's, plus a certain semicircular deformation. And now, what is this saying? It is saying that if you look at this kind of manifold of all things you get as embeddings of your von Neumann algebra, if you go on in a completely arbitrary tangent direction, s1, sn, then you deviate, so in a completely arbitrary direction, S1, Sn, you deviate from this manifold at the rate of t squared. But this means that actually the line along which you deviate has to be tangent. And so this somehow tells you that there are a lot of lines which are tangent, and this you can very quickly convert into an estimate on covering numbers of various things. Yes? Yes. Well, it's a matrix whose entries are elements from this standard square. So it's a matrix whose entries are in a von Neumann algebra. So you can have each entry acting by right multiplication on L2 of a von Neumann algebra. So the matrix acts on L2 of a von Neumann algebra, oops, to the power n. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right, sorry. Yeah, this is the identity of that to the power n. I'm sorry. I was too confused with writing tensor squared. I thought it was such a cute trick to shorten the notation.
no. So basically, the main trick here is that if you consider a t squared, so the point is that a t squared covering, say 2t squared covering, of what is technically called the set of microstates for x1, xn, gives you a t squared covering of gamma of x1 plus ts1 xn plus tsn, actually in the presence of s1 xn, if you know what that means. And anyways, if you once you notice that, you can very easily convert this to some estimate on covering numbers and what have you, and it take a few minutes, and out pops the fact that delta north has to be at least n. Okay, and by the way, all this is from a paper that I've recently posted in the archive, so if you're interested, you can just go there for the argument. I don't want to sketch it in too much detail. Anyways, what I'm saying is that the argument is fairly easy. It's just a matter of just noticing that some covering numbers are related. Okay, so that tells you something. Now, let's try to put this theorem to work. So, of course, I told you that free entropy dimension is big if I can produce a deformation that does something or other. So let's actually go and prove that some free entropy dimensions are big. Okay. So first consequence is that if I take x1, xn free semicircular, then this is n. Okay. Now this is completely cheating because actually in the proof, if you look carefully, I'm using already the fact that free entropy dimension for a semicircular family is n. But anyways, you know, we do prove sometimes in mathematics that if something is n, it's n. We're very happy about it. So let's be happy about it. Anyways, I just want to exhibit what deformation there exists. Well, so I have to produce a deformation from L of Fn to L of Fn, free product L of F infinity. Actually, I'll go back to L of Fn, in fact. And this deformation is not exactly the one that Ozawa wrote in his talk, but it's, well, it's actually very related. So let's say that this one is generated by x1, xn, and this one is generated by x1, xn, and y1, yn. These are all free semicircular. So alpha t of xj will simply be cosine t xj plus sine t yj. And a little bit if you know a little bit about Vokulescu's free Gaussian functor and what have you, you know that whenever you take a rotation of a semicircular family, it's still a semicircular family, so that gives you a well-defined embedding of here into there. Of course, at time t equals 0, just does this. And if you differentiate it, you see that alpha t of xj is, of course, xj plus t yj plus high order terms. Now, these yj are exactly what I called sj in this theorem, and so it's exactly the situation where q is identity, and so, indeed, free entropy dimension is at least n. Okay? Very silly, but still. Let's do something a little more involved. Let's say that m is the Feynman algebra generated by x1, xn is diffuse. And let's construct an extremely silly deformation of it. I take M free product L of F1, also known as L of Z. Okay? And this has a single, well, let's say it has a single semicircular variable that generates it. And let's look at alpha t, which sends xj to S1 to the it xj, S1 to the minus IT. So I just take this semicircular and make a unitary out of it. Now, if you look at what this does to first order, it of course gives you XJ, plus what happens is that you pick up the commutators between XJ and S1, right? You get the commutator between XJ and S1 times T up to sine. It depends on how you define the commutator too. And then you have higher order terms. Okay, so in this case, this matrix Q, well, the way I've insisted that it be a square matrix, but anyways, it ends up being the matrix of commutation with X1, commutation with Xn, and then zeros. Okay, now if you think a little about it, what happens with that, so this goes from L2 of your L2 of m, right? So L2 of m squared to the n to itself.
If you think a little bit about it, its image is one-dimensional exactly when it has no when it has an obvious kernel, which is just everything that that has whichever entry is zero. Anyways, it has an obvious kernel of dimension n minus one, but the fact that nothing, if the Feynman algebra is diffuse, nothing in here can commute with x1, xn, so you don't pick up any extra kernel. And so the image actually is everything, okay? It's dense in everything. So in this case, the dimension of image is 1 over m tensor m, and that's in the case that the Feynman algebra is diffuse. If it's not diffuse, you can still compute exactly the image. So anyways, if you assume also that this is indebtable into the ultra power of matrices, then you get that the free entropy dimension of x1 xn is bigger or equal than 1, and this was observed by Kenley Jung, ten years ago, 5 years ago, something like that. It's called hyperfinite monotonicity. Okay, that this, you know, you get with absolutely no work here. So let's see, what else? How about a free product of two Feynman algebras? Let's say that I take M1 free product M2. This is generated by some X1, XN. This one is generated by some Y1, YN. Well, there are two very natural deformations you can... there's one very natural deformation you can construct. So alpha T from here into itself, free product, free group factor. Let's say it's generated by S1, S2. And you just do basically a variation on this guy, only you move the free guys differently. So alpha T of XJ is conjugated by S1. And alpha T of YJ is conjugated by S2. Oops, YJ. And, well, you know, because x's and y's are free, you see that actually this is well-defined. The law is unchanged, but you multiply by unitaries of the appropriate kind. And also, if you work out the derivatives, what happens is that alpha t of xj is xj plus xj commutator s1 times t plus high-order terms, and alpha t of yj is of course the same thing, only you take the commutator with S2, those higher order terms. And then, well, now your matrix is a bit different, namely it has one row of commutators with X's and one row of commutators with Y's, and if you work out the dimension, if these are diffuse, you get the delta naught of X1, XN, comma Y1, YN, is at least as big as 2. And again, I have to assume that they're embeddable in, of course, the ultra power of the matrices. Well, I mean, it may not be optimal in many instances. I mean, for instance, if these have some free entropy dimension, those have some free entropy dimension, expect the sum of them to be there, but for the purposes of things like, you know, applying this kind of statement of Voiculescu that there's no Cartan, etc., this is good enough, of course. By the way, if you're interested in amalgamating, sir. Yeah. Oh well, so right. So I mean, yeah. I should really, yeah. Oh. What I mean is I convert it to a unitary. So I take e to the I t log rho of s. E to the I t s one, right? Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, otherwise it doesn't quite come out right. Anyway, so well, you get that. Let's see, what I was going to say is that here, I mean, you can amalgamate over something finite dimensional, for example, if you wanted to. It just makes these a bit more delicate to set up, but you'll get an estimate that this is 2 minus some size of this two-dimensional piece over which you have to match the derivations, and so you get that. Let's see. So, maybe you're getting tired of these examples. So maybe at this point I should tell you what this has to do with this algebra of Q semicircular elements. You see, if you go by it the way I've done it, which is to write down the deformation first and then apply this theorem, you don't get very far, because just about the only times where you can write down these derivations these deformations explicitly is where things involve free products, such as this case, this case, which doesn't involve free products, but anyways, it's fairly silly, or this case, and so on. So, I mean, in things where things are kind of algebraic, you can just write down by hand these kinds of deformations, and then you can just apply the theorem and be happy. Okay. However, in the case of these Q semicircular variables, you cannot be so happy, unfortunately, because there's no obvious way to write down a deformation that does this. By the way, these Q semicircular algebras do have a natural deformation, which is very much like this rotation. Unfortunately, we don't have a clue as to what kind of deformation that is, except that the completely positive maps you get from that deformation by embedding and then projecting back do give you that these algebras have a Haar-Groop property. I should have mentioned that they have a Haar-Groop property. Okay? But unfortunately, we have very little control over their infinitesimal behavior, so we certainly cannot claim anything like that, unfortunately, or even weaker, the fact that, you know, if you take L2 of this algebra and subtract the image of the algebra under the zeroth deformation, we don't know what kind of bimodule that is. That would be interesting in connection with the work of Serene and Tuck. Anyhow, so how do you handle this kind of stuff in the case that you don't have such an obvious algebraic structure? So the idea here is the following. After all, if you have this alpha t from some phenomenon algebra generated by x1, xn, into some kind of phenomenon algebra M, then if it is differentiable, if I can write alpha t of xj as alpha naught of xj plus t something of xj plus high order terms, well, let's see if I could write this, okay, let's say for any x in the algebra generated by x1, xn, and just the algebraic algebra generated by them, then you see that what goes in here is naturally derivation. Okay, this delta is a derivation from the algebra generated by x1, xn into M, where M is a bimodule over alpha 0 of your phenomenon algebra x1, xn, tensor square. Well, all right, the bimodule over it, just acting by left and right multiplication. So the situation here, so if you kind of want to go in reverse, you can imagine that you're given a derivation, but not from an algebra into itself, but from an algebra into a bigger algebra. And what you want to do is to convert it back into a one-parameter family of embeddings of your original algebra into the larger algebra. So the question is, given a derivation from some M into some other algebra, let's call this I, from N into some M, can one exponentiate it? So I guess I need this plus an embedding alpha naught from N into M. So that, otherwise the derivation doesn't make sense. I mean, otherwise I cannot view M as a bimodule over N. Can one exponentiate it to a one-parameter family of embeddings alpha t from
n into n.
Okay, so if I have a single embedding plus an infinitesimal, can I patch them together to get a one-parameter family of embeddings? Of course, in the case that n equals m, this is the classic story. You have a derivation on a Feynman algebra, densely defined. When can you exponentiate it to a one-parameter group of automorphisms? Of course, Ola Bratteli is the expert on these kinds of things. And these are very delicate, unfortunately.
Everybody who's ever tried working with them knows.
So, because of the connection with free entropy dimension and L2-Betti numbers and so forth, the specific question that you really want to ask is this. Let's say that you have n, the Feynman algebra generated by x1, xn, and a derivation delta from n into L2 of n, tensor L2 of n. When can this be exponentiated to alpha t, taking n into n, free product L of f infinity, such that alpha t of x is equal to x, meaning x just sitting in here, plus, so the what I'm going to do is I'm going to, this is the Feynman algebra generated by S1, Sn, and the rest, I'll identify n, Sj, n, with n, tensor n. So the closure of this with L2 of that. So what happens here is that this is just delta of xj sharp sk, sharp the vector s. So in this sense, I mean, you see, this delta of xj, let's even say that this goes to this n times, so that I get a vector of elements in L2 tensor L2, which identify with n sj tensor sj, and this is the identification, plus higher order terms. So of course, if you can do that, you see immediately that this kind of a derivation gives rise to exactly the kind of deformation that you're interested in for the purposes of the estimate. So the idea, so I had another way of doing this, which is a bit more complicated. So the idea that I'm going to develop in this talk was suggested to me by Alice Guionnet. Which is to construct alpha t via a free stochastic SD. Free SD, so free stochastic differential equation. So the theorem that one is able to prove so let me cause over this a question. So if one of two things happen, delta from the algebra generated by x1, xn to L2, let's call this A, to L2 of A, tensor L2 of A, satisfies, first of all, it's algebraic, meaning to say that it takes A into A tensor A, no closure, so in the algebraic tensor product here, and if you look at the adjoint of delta, so you assume that delta is closable as an operator from L2 to L2, and the adjoint is sufficiently well defined, so if you take this on A, this takes you back to A. That's an extremely strong condition, unfortunately. Okay, so in these situations, Q1 has positive answer. The other possibility is that x1, xn is a Q semicircular family, Q small, some constant depending on n, which is that constant that I need for my stuff to work. And this time around, delta, well, it's a derivation from the algebra generated by x1, xn,
to some kind of analytic functions on in 1A tends to A. I'm being very imprecise, but what I mean to say is that you take a little bit of a closure of this A tensor A, where you permit infinite series, as long as that these infinite series are convergent in a very strong sense, so they have radius of convergence which contains the size of these operators, given by delta of xj is some specific operator cj, some specific function, explicit operator. In this case, automatically d star d of takes n of anything analytic in x1 xn is analytic in x1 xn, and then also you have that q1 has a positive answer. So you're writing down some free stochastic differential equation, and under these conditions, which are satisfied for a q-semicircular family, what I'm saying is that for a q-semicircular family, there is a q, which is not finite, it's a power series, but still you're able to push the analysis far enough to conclude that this differential equation does have a solution, and this differential equation provides you with the deformation you need. Maybe I should write down what this differential equation is. So the idea is that you could consider a differential equation like this. So it's some qij, so xi, let's say, sharp sj, dsj, minus, let's say, ci of xt1, xtn. Careful. Some q ij of x1, xt1, xtn sharp dsti minus 1 half c of ci of x1, xt1, xtn. And the issue is existence of stationary solution. So stationary solution means a solution. So solution of this is a process. It's a family of operators, x parameterized by the number t. And at each fixed t, they have a certain law. So they generate a certain Feynman algebra. And the stationarity of this is saying that the law is the same, meaning to say that these Feynman algebras are all isomorphic in a way that takes these xt's back to x0. Okay, so it's precisely providing you with this alpha t. So this alpha t takes xj to xtj. And the fact that the solution is stationary is exactly the requirement that this map be a map of Feynman algebra, so it's be trace preserving. So you see, the difficulty here is that, first of all, we have to make sense. What does it mean that this Q and C and so forth? And first of all, we have to make sense of what they are. Well, that's not very hard, actually. This Q, in this case, I should put it here. Q is just del, or Qij is del of x I, jth coordinate, because del, remember, goes, oops, I keep forgetting this, to an n tuple of these guys. Okay. So it's the jth coordinate of this derivation, and this c is just del star d. So cj is del star d of xj. So these you can sort of try, del j star. So you can sort of make sense of them without too much of a, you can see what they should be, but you have to now make sense of them for fairly arbitrary operators for the machinery of stochastic differential equations to work. So that's why we require them to be formal power series, or at least some kind of convergent power series in these kinds of things. And then, of course, you have to prove that this stationary solution exists, which actually is some analysis, not totally trivial, much harder than I thought originally. Anyways, and then, by the way, I should mention that the example where this is satisfied, so where you have a derivation with these properties, these are
limit laws of random matrices with potential.
That's one example where this is satisfied, but it's a bit silly because the limit laws of random matrices with potential you can anyways prove. If you can prove R omega embeddability, then you can actually prove a very good estimate for free entropy. Forget free entropy dimension. Another interesting case where this is satisfied, and this is where I'll end my talk, is let's call this 1 and 2. So 1 is satisfied for certain amalgamated free products of groups. So 1 is satisfied for amalgamated for the class of groups containing, first of all groups with vanishing first Betti number, so that includes amenable groups and property T groups, finite groups. Okay, closed under finite index extensions and subgroups. So if you take a group in this class, if you go to finite index subgroup or finite index extension, you stay there. And by the way, this also contains all groups which are products of two infinite groups. And thirdly, amalgamated free product over finite. And so for all of these guys, just as a consequence of this theorem combined with the theorem above, you get that free entropy dimension of that group is equal to the first Betti number plus a correction, right? Displayed at 0. So this was observed for a very similar class of groups, and I think we also allowed amalgamation over amenable by Ken and Nate and Kenley. Okay, so I think I quit here. Well, I think this theorem, the free entropy dimension for these guys is big, is basically due to Ken and Nate and Kenley. And so I don't think what I've done here, I think I've noticed also that you can go to finite index subgroups, which is sort of silly anyways. And so I don't think it really, it just says that anything you can manufacture out of free products doesn't have Cartan. But I think more interesting is just proving, providing examples where you can exponentiate that beyond this algebraic nonsense, which unfortunately is just, it's a pain. But, yeah. Well, so if the free entropy of x1, xn were finite, then you would automatically know the free entropy dimension is n. For what? For? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Do you have any idea whether it happened then actually
because it's healthy? Certainly, it depends a bit on the situation. If this Q does not have full image, if this Q is not equal to n, then it cannot, of course, because the free entropy dimension is n. Now, if you assume that Q has image which is big, then both can happen. For instance, in the one-dimensional case, where all of this works much nicer, if you take a single variable, you can, of course, have one which has a non-atomic measure. So free entropy dimension is 1, and then you can make it smooth, and then free entropy will be finite, or you can make it very bad, and then free entropy will be infinite. And so by taking free products, of course, you can produce such things inside various n-tuples. So I think there would be instances. If you assume that you have an algebraic derivation which is algebraic, I don't know. Probably there it's, I don't know what happens to free entropy. But certainly if you go
sufficiently far from algebraic, then I don't know what happens. But I mean, it's true that this technique here is so silly when applied to free entropy dimension that one really wants to apply it to free entropy itself. And what that would lead to is some kind of transportation cost inequality and things around that, but there are technical problems with that.
In the case of the form of tensor, I sort of missed, what exactly is the operator Q, matrix Q?
Oh, yeah, so this matrix Q, the related question is, what's this derivation that you write down? Okay? So it's easier to tell me what the derivation is than its range. The derivation is simply, you represent these operators acting on the computer form Fock space, and the derivation is the right, so there's an n-tuple of derivations because you go into the nth power, and the jth derivation is the commutator with the right creation operator. That operator for small q is Hilbert Schmidt, and this Hilbert Schmidt operator sits here. But you identify Hilbert Schmidt with L2 tensor L2. For even smaller q, it's not just Hilbert Schmidt, it's actually Trace Klotz. So actually it's somehow an analytic power series in these variables. That's somehow the point. Right, that's one of the places where the obstruction on the size of q comes in. But actually, you even have to make it slightly smaller, because to solve this differential equation, you have to at some point iterate. And when you iterate, there's a certain operator. I mean, you see what you have to do. You have to take this C, then you have to apply del star to it. So you have to kind of apply the adjoint of this derivation to it. It gives you a much messier power series. But then you have to iterate this procedure and have an estimate of how much it grows. And there, unfortunately, you have to even make Q slightly smaller stuff. So it's unfortunately, in this case, painful that you have to do these kinds of things. But that's all I can do. Yeah. I don't think it's known. I certainly have not heard of it. As I said, the way you prove that, this C actually has another name. It's a Hilbert-Schmidt operator, tell you all my secrets now. What it does on the Fock space is it multiplies tensors of length n by q to their degree. Okay, this is what this operator is. And so this is a kind of a number operator of sorts. And that is the guy that gives you the fact that you have the compact approximation property, essentially. But I don't know if, maybe what Taka was explaining by extending it to the complex domain and doing something there, maybe this can give some information. I have no clue.
Okay.